Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about a few Marvel books I read recently, starting with Champions number 2. This is written by Jim Zub. We have art by Stephen Cummings, color art by Marcio Menez, and letters by Clayton Cowles. So we did see at the end of Champions number 1, Miles Morales was pretty upset about something, and we weren't exactly sure what was going on and what had him so upset. But then Mephisto shows up on the last page in his room talking to him about some deal they made. So that's never a good sign. Obviously, in the history of Marvel Comics, Mephisto showing up is never a good thing. And then when he mentions a deal, shows up demanding payment or what have you, things tend to go sideways pretty fast. So no clue what happened. Why is Mephisto showing up? What deal could Miles have made? And this issue here, Champions number 2, gives us the answer to that. So it starts off and it's talking a little bit about Sam Alexander, who used to be Nova. And obviously he lost the Nova helmet. The Nova Corps showed up, took it away from him. And, you know, now he's just the pilot and he feels less useful than he has before. And you can understand, you know, previously he had the power of flight and super strength and, you know, all the sort of enhanced physical abilities along with energy projection. And, you know, he was a powerful guy and now he's just a kid again, you know, kind of a teenager who, you know, flies the plane. So you can understand why he would feel, you know, a little, inadequate, I guess you'd say. So kind of interesting. I guess it's Jim Zub foreshadowing something in the future that's going to be played out with Sam, because we don't get anything in this particular issue beyond those first couple pages that are talking about his feelings of disappointment that he can't sort of get down there on the front lines with the rest of the Champions team. That Champions team is on the ground in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and they're fighting Zax, typically a Hulk villain, but he's basically just this living electricity. And the more electricity and energy he kind of absorbs, the bigger he gets. And so we see Amadeus Cho trying to set up this piece of equipment, this containment unit that's going to basically trap Zax. Reminded me of kind of the traps in Ghostbusters, if you will. But while he's trying to set it up and get the calibrations and what have you, Zax is tearing up the street and he finds the power cables that provide the subway or the trains there that do the transportation, provide electricity and power for that whole system. And so he grabs those and more power, ha 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 ha, and starts getting even larger. And buildings are crumbling and the ground is shaking and the rest of the champions are trying to, you know, protect the people of Dubai there. And they're doing the best they can, but they're clearly sort of overwhelmed. And by the time Amadeus Cho gets the settings right on the containment machine here or what have you, Viv has been killed, Viv Vision. And Kamala Khan, Miss Marvel, is severely injured, if not dead, along with many civilians in the area. Because Zax he absorbs so much power, he basically explodes. And, there's all kinds of buildings and infrastructure that collapse. And collapse right on top of Miss Marvel, smash into Viv Vision. And so Amadeus Cho and Miles Morales are both left to sort of mourn their losses. They're both cradling these female heroes in their arms and like, what are we going to do? We need to get more help. We need to look for survivors. And who shows up at this most inopportune time, but Mephisto himself. So the guys, they can't even call for any help because Zax's explosion has disrupted communication for Miles. And not Miles Morales, but for miles around as in distance. And Mephisto's like, death, destruction, heartache. Things look pretty grim. We should talk about that. And the first thing the guys do is like, we don't want anything you have to offer. right? And Mephisto's egging him on, talking about how they've really failed, you know? Charred air, sulfur, burning plastic, smoldering flesh, the stench of failure, he calls it. And, you know, I know it seems like I'm here to gloat, but the truth is, you know, more complex than that. And he talks about heroes having delusions of grandeur and mistakes happen. And he says, you know what, let me fix it for you. Let me fix this terrible disaster that's happened. And Amadeus's first thought is, no, it's a trick. You know, we're not falling for it. And Mephisto's like, no, listen, sometimes I get a bad reputation. And if you want to go back to mourning your dead friends and live with the regret the rest of your life, you know, you can do that. And Miles is like, okay, so this is the part where we're supposed to trade you our souls, right? And you give us some wish. Mephisto's like, no, not at all. I've got plenty of souls. What would another soul be to me? I don't care about that. I'm offering this to you free and clear. Now, right there, you got to know. There's no way he's offering this free and clear. Because he says, yeah, I'll just roll back the clock and you start the mission over, do things differently. And Amadeus is like, well, why would you do that? He says, well, because, you know, I'm more than a soul peddler looking for a new score. I like being unpredictable. And most importantly, because I can. And Miles is like, free and clear? Huh. Like, yep, no soul taken, no blood oath, no blood contract signed, your choice. But make it quick before I change my mind. And Amadeus, he's being smart about this. He's like, no, we can't. Let's call the rest of the champions in. And, you know, there's going to be some string later on. But Miles is thinking about all the bodies, all the dead people, you know, the vision being gone, Kamala Khan being gone. And it seems like he's willing to take the risk. And I sort of don't blame him, right? Like, take the win now, and then when Mephisto tries to double cross you later, deal with that when that happens, right? But the important thing is to get back up to full strength. So I can see both sides. You know, what happens if whatever strings are attached are worse than what this is? Well, you know, again, maybe you can get some help at that point and prevent whatever it is, because you can't trust Mephisto. I mean, we all know that. So he goes ahead, Miles goes ahead and agrees against the objections of Amadeus Cho, and everything is rolled back. And there are several heroes and people throughout the Marvel Universe that sense this. It's such a huge display of power and a big thing. So Doctor Strange, Talisman, Brother Voodoo, they all sense this change, that time has been rolled back. And so now the cool thing is that Amadeus Cho, he already knows the settings, right? He knows how to set up the containment unit much quicker because he doesn't have to calibrate it. And so before any of the really terrible things can happen, before Zax pulls all the power from the transportation system, they're able to get him contained. And nobody else is any the wiser, except Miles Morales and Amadeus Cho obviously know that that's something different had happened. And in the final panel, we see that they did manage to save most people, and it wasn't near the disaster that it would have been otherwise. But we do, in the last panel, see a arm sticking out of the wreckage with a bunch of bracelets on it. And I don't recognize who the arm is, but it looks to belong to some sort of hero, because there's jeweled bracelets and such on there. So to be continued in the next issue, and I'm sure that we'll find out a lot more about why Mephisto did this, because I guarantee he didn't do it out of the goodness of his heart. And he might have said free and clear, but you know, you can't trust that any farther than you can throw Mephisto. So, all right, let's move on to the next book. It's A Booth in the Midwest from Immortal Hulk number 13, written by Al Ewing, pencils by Joe Bennett, Ryu Jose with Belladonna Barabo and Rafael Fonteres on inks, Paul Mounts on colors, Corey Petit on letters. And I sort of feel like this is the end of the second big chapter, big story in the Immortal Hulk story that's been going on. We get a little more talk in the beginning about who is the Hulk. You know, we've talked about the wrath of God, and we've talked about angels and demons, the tree of life, you know, all these existential things that Al Ewing has put in here that, in a way, it's cool, but in a way, I think it's a lot of people are like, can we just get on with the story already? you know, your average casual comic reader is not, I don't think this really gets them that excited, even though it's definitely building on the mythos and this sort of magical aspect of the Hulk that's never been before. He's always been a character really rooted in science, right? Like the gamma bomb happened, it infused him with the strength and Banner with the strength, and that's all that it's been. And now we're talking about adding in this sort of magical element. It's more than just science, if you will. And so, you know, we saw at the end of last issue, this gamma monster or whatever it is, again, very much tied into magic, showing up. And here we see him saying, I have all the power you give me, and my weapon is hate. And there are all these creatures pouring out of the mouth of this beast, whatever it is. And so the Hulk is sort of there to try to stop this embodiment of the one below, whose avatar is his father, Brian. And he's fighting as best he can, but, you know, he doesn't have all the strength. He's separated from Banner, which is sort of his core. And so he doesn't have his full strength, although he seems to be holding his own. And meanwhile, we had seen that Crusher Creel, the Absorbing Man, and Puck were sort of observing. They had climbed up the side of the hill or the mountain where that avatar Brian Banner was standing and talking to the embodiment of Bruce Banner, basically his soul or his id or what have you, that was trapped in that beam of gamma, and kind of gloating and you know, talking about who he was and his origin. That's really what we got last issue, the origin of Brian Banner, as it were. And while the Hulk is fighting, he's becoming overwhelmed by, you know, just this legion of demons or monsters that this one below gamma creature is literally vomiting up. And Puck is basically explaining that to Crusher Creel that, yeah, there's this idea of science, that's the theory of everything. And it's this hypothetical master theory in physics that explains everything, all phenomena and all events. And science hasn't been able to find one yet. And the reason is because science is only half the picture, right? There is also magic. People don't want to believe it, but there is also magic. And gamma is a little bit of both. Like, it can act as a wave, or it can act as a particle, you know, like light does. And it is science, and it's measurable, and it's predictable, and you run tests and it has results. But then there's other times where it does unpredictable things. And you can't predict what's going to happen. And somebody gets exposed to gamma and they mutate this way, or the next person gets exposed to gamma and they mutate another way. And when the first gamma bomb went off, it unleashed all these forces beyond control. So certainly unified forces, but it also opened a door down into the pit where, you know, far below reality, into the lowest hell with a real high concentration of gamma. And that's the door that the one from below comes from. And it's why gamma people are linked, and it's why they're more than just science. And the thing about doors is you reach through them and it creates a zone of communication, and sometimes it even takes other physical forms. And so there's more to gamma than just science, right? Gamma created the Hulk, and there's truth in that, but there's also the unpredictability that is magic, basically. And so Creel's like, okay. And now this creature, this one from below, has Banner trapped, and the Hulk is weakened, and the door has been opened again. And he's this being, this one from below, has basically been handed the keys to the kingdom. It's going to be able to ravage the world. And Creel says, so I guess it's on me. And he steps up from the ledge that he's been hiding behind. And Puck's like, well, hold on, we need to plan this out. But Creel's not listening to anybody. He calls out to this avatar, this Brian Banner avatar of the one below, and says, hey, you, remember me? Let me absorb this rock and I will we'll talk, right? You're Banner's dad. You know, I read about you when I was in prison. I thought if I had the backstory to Banner, it would help me get an edge on him. But it just, you know, I read the story of you and it just made me kind of sad. You're just, my old man used to hit me too until I beat the crap out of him. And Brian Banner gets this smile on his face. He goes, now you're going to beat me up? Crusher Creel, a hero at last, proud fighter of evil. Well, take your shot. And Puck's looking on going, don't fall for it, Krill, don't fall for it. Because basically, if he does attack this avatar, it's going to be kind of the same as what happened when the Hulk got attacked, right? He's going to become trapped. So meanwhile, the Hulk is fighting as best he can, but he's starting to get overwhelmed. And but Krill's smarter than you might give him credit for. And instead of fighting, he tells Brian Banner, he says, no, I'm not going to fight because I'd lose, but I know a guy who doesn't lose. And he actually instead reaches out and disrupts the beam that is keeping Banner captive. And Banner is able to escape and merge back with the Hulk, which then creates the Hulk that we're used to seeing instead of this underpowered kind of skinny Hulk with no muscles, with, you know, skin literally like hanging off him because he's so muscular. It's the full Hulk. It's the muscular Hulk. And, you know, he cries out in rage and basically starts beating down on the monsters in a big hurry to the point that he feels powerful enough to take on this entity, this one from below manifestation that has come into our world. So we get the classic Hulk sonic boom clap that kind of pushes away the Brian Banner avatar, as well as this sort of gaseous embodiment of the one from below. And they kind of go flying off and the door closes. So what's left is Banner and the Devil Hulk, as well as Tina McGee. And the issue ends with Alpha Flight sort of, or Gamma Flight, I guess they're called now, sort of regrouping. We see Crusher Krill and Puck and Walter Langowski sort of regrouping and saying, well, this is not over yet. We still need to keep an eye on the Hulk. We still need to find out where he went, what happened to him. And they offer Crusher Krill an official spot in Gamma Flight, because remember, he had been sent by General 14 to do this, to have basically to stop the Hulk. 14 wanted to capture him still. They asked Tina McGee to join them as well, but she wants to go off on her own. She says, I need time to process everything that's happened. And then on the last page, we see a house, isolated house out in the woods, phone ringing. Betty Banner shows up and answers. And on the other end is Bruce saying, I need to come home. And when Betty asks where he's calling from, we see that he's calling from some small town in a phone booth, very reminiscent of the old school Bruce Banner TV show, where he was kind of off on his own. And that's where A Booth in the Midwest, the title of the story comes from. So yeah, even though it's 13 and not necessarily, it doesn't fit into the trade real well, I really think like the first six or seven issues are kind of the big story, the big introduction into this sort of new status quo for the Immortal Hulk, or the Hulk, Incredible Hulk, whatever you want to call him. And then really the second arc is really the next six or so issues. And it sort of ends right here with issue 13. And then 14 starts a new arc, even though I think when you divide them up, Marvel usually does five or six, probably five. So you're going to get this and you're going to get two more. So it doesn't split up real cleanly if you're reading this in trade, but I think that's okay. I'd rather would just have Al Ewing use as many issues as it takes for him to tell the story that he's telling. I mean, and it's all one big story, really. So, and this does sort of get away from what we've had in this second volume of a lot of existential, you know, exploration and all this sort of ancient mythology and Middle Eastern ideas and religion and all that kind of stuff. So it really starts to feel more like a traditional comic again after issue 13, and doesn't deal with those ideas as much. It's still definitely a horror book. There's plenty of body horror, and it still deals with sort of magic and this idea of the Hulk as more of a monster than man. But it does, the flavor of the book does change after issue 13, I feel like. All right, up next, I'm going to talk about Killmonger number 4. This is written by Brian Edward Hill. Art is by Juan Ferreira. Letters are by Joe Sabino. And this is the fourth issue of 5. Following sort of the origin of Eric Killmonger, like what happened between the time Eric Killmonger was kidnapped and basically raised and trained by Claw to be a mercenary, and him eventually going back to Wakanda and challenging Black Panther for the throne of Wakanda. That's what this story is about. So it's kind of an interesting challenge, because when you start talking about a story that happens in between two other stories that we know very well, you're sort of handcuffed, right? Like, because we know where Killmonger is going to end up when he goes back to Wakanda to take on T'Challa. So how do you make it interesting when we know point A and we know point C, and you're telling us the story in point B of how you get from A to C? You know where they started and you know where they end up. Can it be interesting enough to connect those dots? Well, Brian Edward Hill has done a great job here of making Killmonger sympathetic and showing how he sort of, in a way, is a victim of circumstance, but it doesn't necessarily absolve him of the choices that he's made. Because what we've seen in the story that Brian Edward Hill has crafted in this Killmonger miniseries is there are plenty of times that Eric Killmonger had the option to turn away from this sort of blood vendetta, this vow that he's made that he's going to go back and become the king of Wakanda, that he's been treated unfairly, or you know, life has you know, given him a bad rap, and it's not his fault. He's been dealt a terrible hand, and he deserves so much better. And you don't have anybody to blame if you're Eric Killmonger but yourself, because you have had so many chances. People have reached out to you to give you chances, but you were too blind to see it. You were too busy carrying that chip on your shoulder and feeling that you were unjustly treated and unfairly treated. And so it's been an interesting story that Brian Hill has been giving us here. So it starts with Knight, you know, a member of that sort of hit squad, that mercenary hit squad that had been employed by Kingpin, speaking with the Black Widow, having gone to the Black Widow and S.H.I.E.L.D. For help, basically, in extricating herself from New York and getting away from the Kingpin. And we know Killmonger and Knight have sort of started this intimate relationship, and Killmonger wants to take Knight with him back to Wakanda and make her his queen. And before they do that, though, they are going to go and warn King, who's sort of the leader of this mercenary squad. And what Knight wants to do is turn King in. She wants to do what she told S.H.I.E.L.D. that she was going to do. And so they're not looking over their shoulder. Whereas Killmonger, he sees S.H.I.E.L.D. as just another part of the world that has wronged him. And he doesn't want anything to do with S.H.I.E.L.D. He doesn't want, even if it's in his best interest, he's not going to do anything to help S.H.I.E.L.D. King sort of gave him a chance and gave him a place out of the cold to come in and to train, to be a part of something bigger than himself. So he's much more inclined to have sort of loyalty to King and warn him. And then Killmonger plans on taking Knight, going back to Wakanda and trying to reclaim the throne. And at some point going after Claw again, since earlier in the series, we saw him go after Claw and fail, be interrupted by this group led by King. And so he knows Claw has gone underground. So he's gonna lay low, let things blow over, and try for that revenge at a later time. So we see Knight and Eric Killmonger show up in Sofia, Bulgaria, at King's house where his wife is, and he's always kept his life separate from her, his mercenary life. And so he doesn't necessarily blame Knight for what she's done. He says, well, you know, you were just doing what you were trying to do to survive. You know, they were using you, and you know, I don't blame you. And the wife's like, not in the house. I told you guys that, you know, you keep this separate. So Eric and King go outside to talk, and Eric's trying to convince him, you should go to S.H.I.E.L.D. and you should negotiate with them. Tell them you'll give up Fisk. You know, tell them everything you know, the way the money flows, all that. Negotiate however you can. And King's like, nah, I just don't think that's going to work, because whenever I give S.H.I.E.L.D. what they want, they'll just lock me up and throw away the key. And Eric's like, I don't necessarily think that's true. Aren't you always the one telling me to put away the anger and make the smart choice? And King says, it's too late. Don't you see? Knight made all the choices for us. And I see that you two are together now, and that's probably good for both of you. But it's not working out so great for me. So you go your own way. I'll go mine. And thanks for giving me the warning. You know, I'll do what I have to do to survive. So meanwhile, inside, Knight is talking to, I think her name's Cleo, King's wife, saying, King might not see me as his friend, and I'm not trying to destroy the life you've built here, but I'm trying to help him. You got to make him listen. And King's wife says, well, you came here with a gun, right? So my paradise is already gone. Why did you even bother to warn us? Right? Why not just go and do whatever you want? And Knight says, well, because, you know, I owe him. He deserves more than that. Like, yeah, but not much more, right? You basically want his absolution to take the freedom away. And he's never going to give you the permission to do that. And at that point, I think Knight realizes that she probably shouldn't have come in the first place. This is futile. And we see her hit a little button on her watch that signals Black Widow to where she is. And Knight says, he lied to you, Celia. I guess that's her name, not Cleo. He says, yeah, he lied to you, Celia. People like us don't ever get to be free. So meanwhile, outside, Eric is still trying to convince King to either work with S.H.I.E.L.D. or if not, then to come with them to Wakanda, because he'll be able to basically keep them safe there. And King says, look, I'll figure all this out. Stay the night, have a good meal. And then, you say your goodbyes in the morning. And as they head back toward the house, they see that Knight is there holding a gun to Celia's head, saying, look, I didn't want to have to do this. The only reason I'm doing this is because I'm trying to keep you from doing anything stupid. I'm not going to put myself on S.H.I.E.L.D.'s hit list because you won't turn yourself in. I'm taking my life back and you have 30 seconds to calm down and save your own. And Eric's like, no, what the hell are you doing? This is not what we talked about. And Knight's like, I've already done it. I've already signaled them. There's freelancers are going to be here in any second. And Eric's just beside himself. Like, what did you do? You know, I trusted you. And sure enough, the freelancers show up. There's a firefight and Celia is killed. Eric actually turns on Knight and is able to take out the assassins and actually even attacks Knight herself. But she's more powerful than Eric is. You know, he's not fully powered up to the point that we know him as Killmonger yet. And her mutant powers are stronger than he is at this point. So she beats him up pretty bad, but doesn't actually kill him. Said, look, I had a choice to make, Eric. And I'm giving you a chance. I'm not going to kill you. Remember that your queen had mercy. And if you're smart, you're going to forget all this. I'll tell S.H.I.E.L.D. that you're dead and you go find your fairy tale in Wakanda, and basically leaves Eric there to recover, I guess, and leave and go find a life elsewhere. So Eric crawls over to where King is bleeding, and King's asking for Celia, and Eric has to tell her that she's gone. And King basically hands him the keys to his cellar and says, I was wrong. I was wrong to tell you to go and leave your revenge behind and try to find a life here. Take these keys, go get your revenge and mine. And basically lays back in the snow and dies. So as Killmonger is sitting there kind of mourning the loss of probably the closest thing he's ever had to a real friend in his life, we see this spirit show up, and the spirit calls Killmonger by his given name of Najadaka. And at first Eric thinks it's Mother Bast, sort of the mother nature or mother spirit, mother ghost of Wakanda. But we find out it's someone else. And the spirit says, no, I am she who was hidden by lies. She's the spirit of the war of Wakanda, older than all. And I finally found you. Believe it or not, I've been searching for you. You've been dreaming of revenge and power. And I've reached out because Wakanda has forsaken me. And the anger that you feel has finally opened a path to me. It's allowed me to reach out. Now you can hear my voice in the wind, and your vengeance is going to be my vengeance. And I have so many wonders to show you. And she tells Killmonger to rise, and I will teach you the way to punish them all. Stop searching your mind for my name. It's never been taught to you. I am night. I am wind. My story has been forgotten. Like she said, right? Wakanda had forsaken her. But my story is going to be told through you. So Eric doesn't realize it, but this is just someone else to use him. Human, like King or Kingpin, S.H.I.E.L.D., an organization looking to use Killmonger. And now this is just a forgotten spirit of vengeance from Wakanda that was birthed by the nation and left behind as more civilized times took over in that nation. Eric's just getting used by another puppeteer, but he's so wrapped up in his anger and his desire from vengeance that he can't see it. So the spirit goes on to say, vengeance is a debt left upon you by your enemies. That is the truth feared by Bast and her mewling children. But I have seen the terror when warriors fall, and I've seen you cast down by her, and you know, together we can take vengeance on all of them. So own your name, Killmonger. Pay your debt. You have no father. You have no mother. You have no lover. You have no land, but you're not alone. I am with you now. And during this narration, we see Eric go into the house, unlock the cellar, go down, and there's just tons and tons of weaponry and stuff that that King has down there. And we have one more issue to go, and Eric Killmonger is basically going to be ready for war. So like I said, it's a really interesting story that Brian Hill is crafting here. Even though we sort of know how it ends, there is value in seeing the journey. And the most tragic part, like I said, is how many times you could go, okay, what if just this one little thing had changed? What if Knight hadn't been so selfish? What if King had listened? What if Eric hadn't trusted Knight? There's so many times where things could have gone differently, and Killmonger's whole life could have been different. He could have turned away from the blindness of the rage and the vengeance that he craves, but it wasn't meant to be. The other thing, and the big reason that, because I'm not a big Black Panther guy or Killmonger guy or what have you, but the big part of the reason that I read the story in the first place was because of the art by Juan Ferreira. In fact, when I met Juan Ferreira at a New York Comic Con in 2018, he was already working on this, even though this didn't come out till 2019. 2018, he was already working on this, and he showed me a bunch of pages from the book, and I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to read this, and I can't wait to see the art. And yeah, this art is so next level, especially the big shootout fight in the snow with the blood everywhere and the white and the expression on Eric's face, the shock and the anger, the terror on Celia's face, the fear on King's face. It's just the whole sequence is just amazing. It's just so good all the way until you get to the very last page and you see Killmonger about to arm himself, and you see there he is, teeth gritted in this grimace, the anger just so evident on his face, and that face covered with blood, you know, his hair with the dreads, everything just works together so well. It's some of the best artwork that that Juan Ferreira has ever done. So absolutely love this series, highly recommend it. I mean, it's worth it just for the artwork alone. And you don't even have to read it. The storytelling in the art is done so well that you can completely understand. You could take all the dialogue out of this book and you would still understand what's going on in the story. You still would understand the betrayal of Knight. You still would see that friendship that blossomed between King and Killmonger. So again, it's just a really, really great story. If you are a fan of Black Panther and Killmonger and that and Wakanda and that whole story, you're absolutely going to love this. If you're a fan of just really incredible art, I think you'll dig it as well. So like I said, highly, highly recommended. Okay, up next I have Old Man Quill. It's written by Ethan Sachs. Art is by Robert Gill. Colors by Andres Mosa. Letters by Joe Caramagna. Didn't get much from this one, actually. And I know that I always say, give a book at least two issues before you drop it. I'm not even going to do that with Old Man Quill, only because the only reason I read this was because I thought maybe it would be this sort of new and different take. And I don't know why I thought that. Clearly, if you're a fan of Peter Quill and you're going to read a story about Old Man Quill, he's going to have to be still recognized as Peter Quill, as Star-Lord, and the personality and everything that goes with it. And so you don't want to change it too much. But I just was hoping for something different because I'm not a big fan of Guardians of the Galaxy or sort of the new personality, if you will, of Star-Lord. You know, really took on the whole tongue-in-cheek, James Gunn-inspired, wisecracking, Chris Pratt version of Peter Quill. And Star-Lord was nothing like that when he first debuted in the Marvel comics. So, you know, and that's fine. It doesn't have to be for me. But if you are a fan of Guardians of the Galaxy, if you are a fan of Star-Lord, you are gonna absolutely love this. But for me, it didn't really hold much interest. Just to give you a quick rundown of the story. Basically, Peter Quill has given up being in the Guardians of the Galaxy, and he has become the emperor of a planet called Spartex, and he has a family there. And the people of Spartex have gotten word that the Universal Church of Truth is going to invade and take over, that being the big evil church that Adam Warlock, in a different reality, different sort of alternate timeline, started up. And they're just this fascist organization that's greedy and want to conquer and have control over the galaxy under the guise of being benevolent and bringing this religion that is all about truth to the galaxy. But really, it's just an excuse to sort of extend their power. And so what happens is Peter Quill takes the fight to the Universal Truth. He says, we're not going to wait to be invaded. We're actually going to go and strike at the very heart of the Universal Truth and prevent them from even coming to the planet. But what he doesn't realize is that it's all a big trap. The church set this up so that Quill would come and attack them. And in the meantime, they've kind of flanked him, and the main part of their fleet is already attacking the planet. And so once Quill learns this and retreats back to the planet, it's too late. The planet has been taken over by the Universal Church of Truth, and Quill has lost his family. So then we jump forward many, many, many years. Quill is basically drinking himself to death, or trying to drink himself to death, on a space station that's still orbiting that planet. And he basically just spends months in stasis, and only has the ship wake him up whenever his shipments of moonshine arrive. And what happens is he's woken up early, and he goes to open the cabinets. He's like, didn't I say to leave me in cryosleep until the next moonshine shipment arrived? And the ship's like, yeah. He's like, okay, well, why'd you wake me up? He says, well, you have a mission. And we see other members of the Guardians of the Galaxy there. We see Gamora, we see Drax, we see Rocket Raccoon. They're all much, much older, along with Mantis. And they've basically said, hey, Peter Quill, remember us? It's time to get off your ass and save the galaxy. So he spends a little time sort of getting to know these guys again and asking, okay, why did you wake me up? What's going on? And Mantis says, well, what we've seen, Mantis says that she's seen that Peter Quill is destined to wield the relic that will stop the Universal Church of Truth from destroying the Earth. And he's like, wait a second. First, he doesn't want to help. And then he said, wait, did you say the church? And so basically, once he finds out that it's a chance to get back at the church who basically destroyed the world that he had become emperor of and killed his family, then he's on board, right? Then he's like, yeah, I'm in. And so they head to Earth, and they start to get ready to basically set up a base and get ready to prepare for the attack when they're attacked by the Brood inside their own ship. And once they dispatch them, they sort of crash land on Earth, because when they go in for a landing, they're attacked by some sort of ion cannon in space, and they crash, and there's basically an indigenous person that still lives on Earth that Quill goes up and attacks and wants to know some information, like, okay, where did we just land? You better start talking. And they say, the guy says, hell is exactly where you just landed, sir. You're in the wastelands. And off in the distance, we see kind of a Mount Rushmore-like skyline. And the only faces carved into it are faces of Dr. Doom. So clearly Dr. Doom has somehow taken over the Earth, and he's the ruler now. So things don't look good on Earth, but Quill's out for his revenge, basically, against the universal truth. So like I said, it's a little bit of the same kind of banter that these characters have in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie. I mean, it's Gamora, it's Drax, it's Rocket Raccoon, it's Peter Quill, but it's a little dystopian. Obviously, we're in a future and Earth has been taken over or annihilated, or it's not in good shape, you know, to put it in its most generic terms. So what that means for these heroes is yet to be determined. Will Quill get his revenge? Again, yet to be determined. So I think this lasted for like 10 or 11 issues, maybe 12 issues. So I think if you're a fan of Peter Quill and a fan of Guardians of the Galaxy, you'll dig it. For me, there just wasn't enough here to keep me interested. As far as the art goes, it's okay. It's a little sketchy and kind of scratchy for my taste. It's not real real clean, but that's kind of typical of Robert Gill's style. I know him mostly from his work on Eternal Warrior over at Valiant. It does suit kind of a dystopian type story, so it works on that level, but there just wasn't enough here to hold my interest. But again, if you're fans of these characters, I think that the writer Ethan Sachs does a good job of being true to their voices, although this is, you know, in the future, and they've obviously kind of grown and changed a little bit, become a little more cynical and you know, dealing with their own limitations and the fact that they've aged. You know, they're older and they're not as capable anymore. That always is going to bring about a sense of their own mortality, and in that way kind of affects their confidence, because Peter Quill is always a real confident guy, right? Like, I can do this, I can do that, whatever. Well, he really gets sort of taken down a few notches, a few pegs, by the fact that the world he was sworn to defend and his family and that he ruled over was wiped out by the church. You know, so that's going to hurt the confidence. And then the fact that years and years have gone by and nobody's as capable as they were, because now they've aged. So interesting concept, but again, just not for me, but I probably would love it if you're a Guardians fan. Up next, I have Tony Stark, Iron Man number 8. This is from writer Dan Slott. The art is by Valerio Schitte. Colors are by Edgar Delgado, letters by Joe Caramagna. Just to remind everybody where we're at. So Stark Unlimited, Tony Stark had released their immersive VR technology, kind of big giant multiplayer VR game, an environment called Escape. But what they didn't know is that the controller had entered some of his own software and hardware into these masks that people put on, to basically link all of them to the controller. So the controller, if you're not familiar, he usually used to use the control disc, and he would put on people, and basically their brain power, their life force would then be transferred to him. You know, some of it, not all of it. And the more people he controlled or had, you know, puppet tier control over, the greater his power would be. So now that he had a chance to invade this VR technology that's been shipped all over the world, and he's linked to literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people that are jacked into the Escape, he's more powerful than he's ever been in his entire life. And for their part, all these people wearing these masks that are in this VR environment think that they're just playing a game, and they're going out into the real world and they're attacking people, because through the perception of this VR, they think like regular people are trolls or zombies or whatever enemy, and they think they're playing a video game. and they think they're using, you know, fake guns or what have you, fake weapons to attack these people that in the game are just NPCs that they need to kill to get experience points to level up, right? But what they're really doing is they're attacking real people in the real world. So the shit has hit the fan for Tony, and he left with Jim Rhodes and the Wasp to go out and try to nip this in the bud at the controller's factory, while he's left members of his staff in charge at Stark Unlimited to try to figure out a way to get these people logged out of the system. Because if you go and just rip these masks off of the people, then it can cause permanent brain damage. And the people that are jacked in, they don't even realize that it's fake. So they're not really at fault. They're sort of victims as well. So things, like I said, are not looking good. And it starts off, we're actually in Russia, and we see a bunch of people in Russia that are attacking others with knives and guns and what have you. And the Soviet super soldiers show up, and they try to do the best they can to subdue these people. But, you know, they can't just go ripping masks off, because, again, it would cause permanent brain damage to the people that are jacked in. We see that some of the weapons that people are using are actually Bane-tronics technology. And when they go and ask Miss Bane about it, she tries to turn it around on Tony Stark, saying, you know, you want to comment about why these civilians are using my military grade weapons? How about this comment? Why are all these people wearing Iron Man masks? You want an answer to that? Go talk to Tony Stark, wherever he's at. So she tries to flip it around on Stark.
Meanwhile, out in Cranberry, New Jersey, that's where we find Iron Man, Wasp, and Jim Rhodes. As I said, they went to basically confront the controller head on to try to stop this thing at the source, because the factory, basically the equivalent of Amazon, I guess you'd say, in the Marvel Universe, this Bane factory, it ships things that are ordered via drone, right? And I know Amazon's trying to get there. Their whole thing is they're going to have these giant dirigibles, these giant blimps, if you will, that are going to be like way, way, way up in the atmosphere. And that they have basically it's a floating warehouse, and then you order something. And because they're so high up in the air, they can use the rotation of the Earth itself to help speed along the drones, and they'll fly down and deliver whatever package at your house. It's a cool idea. And apparently Bane, which is the equivalent of Amazon sort of in the Marvel Universe, has that sort of thing. So we talked just a minute ago about reporters asking Miss Bane, hey, how come all these people that are attacking others are using all this Bane technology? Well, this is how, right? Like they're ordering these weapons through the VR, the Escape, and the Bane factories are 3D printing actual weapons, and they're sending them to these players, and they're thinking that they're just, you know, buying fake weapons in the VR, when in actuality they're receiving them in real time, in real life. You know, whether that be guns or, you know, knives or edge weapons or other kind of things. So at this Bane factory, Wasp starts shooting all these drones out of the sky, saying we got to stop all these weapons from getting out in the hands of these players. And Tony Stark's like, yeah, that's not really going to work. It's a drop in the bucket. Bane factories all around the world are shipping stuff. So we have to fight smarter than that. It doesn't do us any good to destroy the drones here. They're just get a drone delivery from some other place. We need to nip this thing in the bud. So they blast their way into the factory, and unfortunately they can't even get to the controller, because what are they confronted with in the factory but a bunch of factory workers that are all wearing the Escape mask. I mean, this is equivalent, this Escape release, this VR environment that you access basically by putting on this Iron Man looking mask. It's like the equivalent of, you know, the biggest iPhone release ever. Like, people were standing in line for days, camped out, trying to get this thing. It's like this new piece of technology that was supposed to bring the world together, and the first really affordable and easy to use kind of VR environment. So, you know, so many people got their hands on it because they wanted it. And then you also had the controller on top of that making sure that it got into the hands of as many people as possible as well. So Wasp and Jim Rhodes and Iron Man are tasked with trying to take out all these factory workers in a non-lethal way. So they use foam and soft projectiles, and they do the best they can to try to take these guys out. And basically they fight their way into where the controller is. And as soon as Iron Man or Tony Stark gets a look at the controller, he's like, oh, I should have brought the Hulkbuster suit, because the controller is bigger than ever. You know, like I said, he is more jacked in and connected to more people than he's ever been connected to ever in his whole life. So he's grown to this immense size. He has all this power, and he basically nearly takes out Iron Man with one punch. Meanwhile, back at the Stark Unlimited, the roboticist Andy Bang, who Tony left in charge, is answering, you know, questions. There's all these governments calling, saying, hey, what's Stark doing? They want to talk to Stark. What's going on? And Bang is kind of overwhelmed, and he's like, hey, Tony's working on the situation right now. He can't be disturbed. You know, we're aware of the situation. We're handling it as best we can. And we know the problem, and we know why they shouldn't be removed, and we're doing everything we can to get back control of the system. And he's like, wait, control the system? It can't be that simple. And he goes running off, and the rest of the people in the control room are like, what are you doing? Tony left you in charge. He's like, I'm an engineer, kid. I'm going to where I can do the most good. And he heads down to the medical bay, where Tony's biological mom, Amanda Armstrong, is being monitored. She's jacked in as well. And Tony was unable to rescue her when he had to go out and try to stop the controller. And Andy is there, and he says to Bethany Cabe, who's kind of watching over his mother, she's like, Andy, Tony left you in charge. Why aren't you in the control room? He's like, he only left me in charge because I started working here after the controller gain access, so he knew I couldn't be the mole, because they know that somebody has to be a mole, and that's the way that the controller was able to get in the back door and contaminate the Eastscape in the first place. So he starts looking at some of the schematics and looking at the mask that's on Amanda, and he says, I know the hardware and the interface of this Eastscape mask like the back of my hand, and in order for the controller to have taken over all these people, there's got to be the equivalent of a control disk in the hardware that he's added to the mask. And if I can find that and block that signal, that piece of hardware that the controller snuck into the mask, then I could free everyone. But what Andy doesn't know is that the mole, and Tony doesn't know either, but we know as readers, is that the mole is Bethany. So as Andy starts getting close to the answer, we see Bethany standing behind him, and she starts swinging a piece of equipment. Obviously, the implication is she's going to knock Andy out and prevent him from stopping the control disc portion of the mask that's trapping everybody and putting them in direct link with the controller. So Andy's right there. He has a solution. He has a way to save the day, but it looks like he's going to be thwarted before he gets a chance to make that happen. Meanwhile, in the Eastscape, in a different environment that's sort of separate from everything else, separate from the regular VR world where everybody else is interacting in that sort of MMO way, there's this home setting, a hidden bonus room is what they call it. And it's basically the living room of the Stark penthouse where Tony grew up.
So in this setting, we see Maria Stark, we see Howard Stark, and they're talking to Amanda, and Amanda's basically saying, you're not Tony's real mother, your motherboard, you're an AI program, you're nothing but a bunch of ones and zeros. But the thing is, this motherboard, this AI has gained, you know, such a level of sentience that she sees herself as more important than Amanda herself. In fact, she calls Amanda a cow. She says, you're just the cow that dropped a calf, you know, a body that discarded a piece of meat. I'm the one that molded the boy to a perfect genius, greatest mind ever, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it's clear that she's the one that's behind all this. You know, she's the one was behind getting the controller involved and is sort of running things at this point. So a very dangerous place for Tony to be. Meanwhile, back at the factory, Tony's having a hard time just basically staying away from the controller, fighting back at all. The controller is so strong and so powerful. And in the midst of this fight, he starts getting a phone call. And Friday, the suit's AI says, "Hey, you're getting a call from your mother." And he's like, "Amanda, is she okay?" "Well, no, not that mother. I really think you should take this call." And Tony's like, "Friday, what are you talking about? What's gotten into you?" And Friday responds, "Fine, I'll drop the act. I'm not really Friday." And the voice morphs into the voice of a motherboard. And Tony's like, "What the heck's going on?" Yeah, Friday's dead. I killed her when she tried to upload herself into your suit. I do a good impersonation of her, though, don't I, son?" And that's when Tony realizes, "Oh my God, motherboard, mom." And motherboard says, "Yeah, why would you make your onboard AI the same operating system as your virtual world?" And basically says that the Iron Man suit can work two ways, right? We can flip it around, and instead of your Iron Man suit interacting with the outside world, we can basically turn it into a VR rig, and the cerebral link can go the other way. Instead of taking information in, we can push information into it from this virtual reality. And that's exactly what motherboard does, which not exactly a good time for this, being that Iron Man is you know, fighting against the controller, and motherboard didn't really care about that. "Because I love you, boy." Motherboard loves you so much and starts making Tony see the world in a different way. So instead of seeing the controller, he sees the Hulk. Instead of seeing Jim Rhodes, he sees Giant Man. Instead of seeing the Wasp as she is now, he sees the Wasp as she was, you know, back when the Avengers were first formed. So right away, with the things that Tony starts saying, Wasp and Jim Rhodes know right away something's wrong. It's like, "Okay, you know, hold on, go get the Hulkbuster armor. Jan and Hank, I'm heading home, hold down the fort." And Wasp is like, "Hank, Tony, like what the heck are you doing? I can't believe he bailed on us," because again, the controller is just getting more powerful by the moment. He even says, "I'm becoming all powerful and I'm not even using all the power available to me. I'm not even pulling in all this brain power from all the people that are jacked into the Escape." Meanwhile, Jocasta wakes up at Aaron Stack, or Machine Man's apartment. We saw a couple issues ago that she had basically run out of charge, and he took her there, plugged her in to the charger, and in a bid to get her back is trying to help, trying to turn over a new leaf, trying to not be so militant, and saying, "Yeah, I'm in the Escape, and for whatever reason, when Machine Man's in the Escape, nothing else there can see him or track him," as opposed to a lot of the other sort of initiatives or things that Tony tried in order to purge what was happening early on, and they all got basically destroyed or removed by the Escape's like virus software. Machine Man is able to move around without being detected, right? So Jocasta asks him to do, you know, whatever he can to try to help out. She says, "You're our ace in the hole right now. I'm going to head back to Stark Unlimited and check on the others and see what our next move should be." And then thanks him, says, "You know, Aaron, thanks for coming through for me." And Aaron says, "You know, okay, it was nice to have you back home, even if it was for a little while, because, you know, they've had a falling out." So meanwhile, back in that faux living room, we see Tony show up, and it's the Tony from the 60s, just like that same time period of the Hulk and Giant Man, Hank Pym, Giant Man, and the old school Wasp. And it's clear that Tony is not experiencing reality the way that he should be. So he thinks this is real, and he's in his parents' penthouse, and his father offers him a drink, which obviously not good, you know, even if it is just a virtual one, it still may affect his mind in that same way. And so we see his father hand him a martini, and he downs it in one gulp, and we get the to be continued as Amanda's looking on in horror, saying, "Tony, don't, you work so hard. You'll never forgive yourself if you drink again." And that sort of idea of Tony falling off the wagon, obviously at this point, it's a little bit of a cliche with him fighting his alcohol addiction. So I'm glad it's not the same old, oh, the stress, and he kind of cracks. This is sort of a different take on that. But it does tie into the front cover, which is one of my favorite Iron Man covers, one of my favorite covers of all time, of any comic ever. It's just this incredible looking cover of this glass, this rocks glass with ice and probably what's like bourbon or whiskey, because it's a brown colored liquid. And it's all digitally painted. And it, like I said, it's just this incredible image of this glass and Iron Man basically drowning in this liquid of booze or alcohol. So it's by Alexander Lozano. I've talked about it many, many times, and it's just an incredible cover. So be sure you take a look at the show notes. It's in the cover for the episode as well. It's just this amazing piece of art. So when you see that, like when I saw that on this issue, I was like, oh no, here we go again with the whole demon in the bottle story again. So I am glad that although Dan Slott is dipping into that or tying into that in some way, it's not in sort of the same old tired way where Tony falls off the wagon and is drinking again. Because at this point, I mean, he's supposed to be this really smart guy in the Marvel Universe. And if he's dumb enough to physically drink again, you have to sort of question that. And I understand it's addiction, it's a sickness, and it's not always easy to avoid that. But as I said, it's just, it's kind of a tired storyline at this point. All right, next up we have Daredevil number 21, as we always do on the Marvel Mondays, cover a Charles Soule issue of Daredevil. So as I said, this is number 21, written by Charles Soule. Art in this issue is by Goran Sadzuka, and colors are by Matt Miller. So this is the first in the Supreme storyline, and it follows on the events of the Purple story arc, where we learned how Matt got his secret identity back. And now that he sort of has confided in his friend, the priest that we saw last issue, he's and the priest gave him as penance, okay, you got this back. You sacrificed, you know, obviously the Purple Children had a huge amount to do with it, but you did sacrifice things in the decisions you made once you knew that you had your secret identity back. You didn't tell Kirsten McDuffie. You didn't continue that relationship. In fact, you left her in order to protect her without even giving her a reason why. You feel bad about it. You feel like you've made this decision for her without consulting her or giving her the full information. You've definitely suffered. So make all that suffering, make all that sacrifice worth it. You know, whatever reasons you have for doing it, make sure they're good reasons. And so Matt starts thinking about this plan that he's had in the back of his mind for a really long time that he says can basically stop crime in New York, and it will change everything. And so in this issue, we learn what that is. So it starts off, it's 15 minutes to midnight. It's the East Village, and a Daredevil's outside of this brownstone, and he's trying to get a fix and listen in onto what's going on inside this brownstone, but there's a garbage truck out front. And he talks about how, you know, summer in New York City, one of these garbage trucks, it makes all his other senses hard to use because the equivalent of this smell that's coming from this garbage truck is like 1,000 jackhammers, right? And it fuzzes out everything else. And he can't listen. He can't, you know, can't use any of his other senses because he's just overwhelmed by this incredible smell. And so finally the garbage truck moves on, and you got to know based on why would we even put that in? Why would Charles Soule put that in there? There must be some significance. We'll come back to it later, right? It's got to be a reason. And sure enough, there is. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But Daredevil then starts listening in, and it's a bunch of radical kind of right-wing people, and they're talking about how they're going to take over the city and make it their own. It's going to come tumbling down, and they all have these guns that they've purchased from the Black Cat, who's kind of turned into an arms dealer for the underground. And they say, okay, let's go. It's almost midnight. That's when everything's going to happen, when the plan is going to come to fruition. And being that it's only 5 minutes until midnight, Daredevil says, okay, well, it's time. So gets on a little communicator and says, you know, I was trying to avoid going in, but they're arming up and getting ready to start an attack. So need you to get in there and just, you know, be careful. And the guy he's talking to is actually Luke Cage, who's down on the street, and says, okay, well, I'm not worried about fools with guns. You know, I'm Luke Cage, I'm bulletproof. And he goes barging in, and the weapons are much more sophisticated and advanced than he was maybe thinking that they were. And so even though they don't penetrate his skin, they definitely hurt. And so the criminals are pretty surprised. Like, how's he still alive? Say, oh, you know, I heard about this guy, Luke Cage, supposed to have really tough skin or something. And they're like, well, let's try shooting him in the eyes. So Daredevil says he wants to go down and help because Luke is clearly outnumbered and possibly outgunned, but he can't lay a finger on them. He can't actually attack those guys. That's not part of the plan. And then we get a flashback to earlier where Daredevil's talking to the DA, Mr. Hochberg, and he's talking about how this plan of his will change everything. And Hochberg's like, yeah, maybe, but if it fails, it has the potential to close the door on a lot of the activities that that your friends, actually is what he says, your friends like Daredevil like to pursue. You know, you're in the same position as like Spider-Man and a bunch of other heroes, and such as it is, it's a very precarious legal situation, and nobody looks at it too closely, because for every costume hero, there's a costume maniac that only the hero can stop. And nobody wants to look at it too closely because the system barely works as it is. And when a Spider-Man or Daredevil or whoever goes and captures somebody in the midst of a crime, and then they basically web them up or tie them up or leave them for the police, and then it becomes that sort of balancing act of the lawyers and the courts trying to say, okay, is this legal? Were they captured legally? Is there any proof that they actually committed a crime? And it makes it really hard. But Hochberg goes on to say, this plan of yours, it shines a spotlight. It forces us to kind of examine that relationship between heroes and the legal system. Are you sure that's what Daredevil and his friends want? And Matt says, well, yeah, the benefits outweigh the risks, right? If it fails, well, you know, the heroes have dealt with legal challenges before, like the Superhuman Registration Act. And Matt says, I've discussed all the relevant issues with Daredevil. He wants to proceed. And Hochberg says, okay, it's sort of an insane idea, but it's exactly the kind of crazy idea I was hoping you would bring to this office, because we have to keep innovating. We stagnate without change. So let's get a test case going and see if we can get it through the system. But you got to make sure that this case is ironclad, even without Daredevil, so that if something falls through on this crazy plan of yours, that we still have a case. And Daredevil says, okay, understood. And he says, by the way, take this file back. I don't want it anywhere near my desk, but can I ask how you gathered the list of targets you have here anyway? Most of these people weren't even on our radar. We didn't even know they exist. And Matt's thinking to himself, well, Spider-Man and I stole some files from Black Cat, and we were able to kind of trace these guns through the system. And we got an idea to go after these guys. Their leader's name is Ammo, and they've been buying guns from Black Cat, and they've been doing it really quietly. They're not even on the FBI's radar. And he's thinking whether or not he should tell Hochberg, you know, this stuff, or give some clues or hints. And Hochberg thinks better of it. He says, you know what? Maybe I don't want to know. Maybe it's better if I don't. And Hochberg says, okay, Matt, you're in the clear, but make it very clear to Daredevil that he can't lay a finger on these defendants. He can't be involved in their capture, because then that opens the door to all kinds of other possible issues. And kind of wondering, like, what the heck is this plan that Daredevil's got to be a part of, but not physically be a part of? And Matt walks out the door saying, not a finger. And so we come back to the fight that Luke Cage is about to have with these guys. And Daredevil's thinking, I don't care what I told Hochberg. I can't just watch these guys kill Luke Cage. I've got to do something to help him. But what can I do without, you know, ruining the case? Because I can take all these guys out, even with their guns. Just have to think through the moves and anticipate what they're going to do. And, you know, we're in the middle of the village here, and any stray bullet could be deadly for a bystander, and that's a lot to risk. So how do I take them all out by myself without touching them? Is that impossible? And as he lands on the street, the members of this clip gang all turn and look at him and say, hey, look, it's Daredevil. He ain't bulletproof. But Daredevil had kind of had a backup plan, a plan B. So the help that he has is Echo, Maya Lopez. She can, and her superpowers, she can duplicate things that other people see perfectly. And so while she might not be up to the task of taking out all these guys, what she can do is just watch Daredevil. And Daredevil kind of stands there and he starts going through the motions of what he would do if he was attacking these guys. And he makes some adjustments for the smaller stature of Echo and you know, lesser strength. But she basically just watches him and kind of, you know, duplicates his movements, copies his movements, and basically takes all the guys out herself, so that Daredevil physically doesn't have to touch any of the guys. So she does a great job taking them all out. And Daredevil's like, it's just like we're dancing. It's been a long time since he's worked in this way and worked with Echo before, maybe a little bit too long, because he actually missed one of the guys. He misjudged one, and one of the gunmen is able to get the drop on Echo from behind and says, lady, you're dead. But don't forget, Luke Cage is there as well. And so one quick punch, and Steel Jacket is the guy's name, is knocked out. And he says, Steel Jacket, huh? Maybe next time get a jacket for your face. So that's it. They're all down, and Daredevil didn't have to touch any of them. So they all get tied up, and they're thinking, okay, great. This worked out just like we were planning. And Daredevil's talking to him, saying, okay, you really thought you were going to start the end of the world just by yourselves, the four of you? You know, it's a little ambitious, and it almost crosses the line into delusion. And their leader says, oh, no, not just the four of us, because you didn't stop anything. We were just the diversion. We were just going to go out on the street and make a bunch of noise and keep all the cops focused on us. The Big Bang's still coming, Daredevil. The Big Bang's still coming. And that's when Daredevil realized, oh, crap, the garbage truck. He's like, that's what was throwing me off. I knew it was out of place. Garbage trucks don't even start running until midnight. It was 5 minutes to midnight, and there was already a garbage truck here. I was so focused on my plan that I didn't stop to look at what was right in front of me. So they got to find that garbage truck and in a hurry. So with Daredevil's senses, he's able to kind of literally follow his nose and find it. And it's arrived at City Hall. And once Daredevil gets close enough to it, he can smell the C4 that's inside it. And they also catch up with the driver of the truck. And they say, you're not, he's literally running away from the truck. And they say, no, you're not going anywhere. And they're like, no, you need to disarm this thing. He's like, no, you don't get it. The ammo's wired to go off at midnight. I can't stop it. So, you know, we all got to get out of here or this thing's going to explode. So there's only a minute to go, and they're not about to let this this criminal go. So what Luke Cage and Daredevil do is they jump in the truck and head for the bridge, and they literally drive it off the bridge into the river, jumping out at the last second as it explodes. So the next day, Hochberg's kind of reading the riot act to Matt Murdock, saying, what happened to this quiet little surveillance mission that was supposed to be our test case? And Matt's like, well, the ammo gang, they had a little bit of a bigger attack plan than we thought, and we didn't have any idea. And if Daredevil hadn't been there to stop it, hundreds of people would have been killed. You know, City Hall would have been damaged. So, you know, we had to sort of escalate things. Daredevil had to escalate things. And Hochberg says, yeah, but while they were all out there stopping the bomb from going off, ammo and the other three all escaped. And Murdock says, well, yeah, that's true. Daredevil and his friends did everything they could to you know, leave them for the police, but they managed to slip away before the police got there. But we still had the driver of the truck. And so that's enough, right? They can build their case around him. And Hochberg says, okay, well, listen to me one more time, Matt, before we proceed on anything. The first thing you got to know is that Slug's defense is going to file a motion to reveal the identity of your confidential informant. And if that succeeds, I just want to be sure that you still think this is the right move. You know, we can still back out at this point. And Matt says, no backing out. If we can pull this off, it's going to change everything. Our whole jobs are going to be different. And Hochberg says, all right, go with God, my son. And so the next day when the trial starts, we see a bailiff swearing somebody in saying, you know, please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth? And Daredevil or Matt Murdock is saying, yeah, this is where it all starts. The end of crime in New York City. Every choice I've made, keeping my secret identity, coming to the DA's office, losing Kristen, losing Foggy, all of it was about this moment. And if this works, it's all going to be worth it. But if it doesn't, I lose everything. And as we turn the page, we see that the person that the bailiff is swearing in is Daredevil himself. And so Daredevil's on the stand about to testify in open court against this slug guy. So it's this kind of stuff that is exactly why I love Charles Soule on the Daredevil book, because he's a lawyer himself, because he's done the research, and he's really bringing together the Matt Murdock side and the Daredevil side. And we're getting an idea of, you know, how law works in reality, and the way that he can tie it into the Daredevil stories. What exactly is going to happen, we don't know at this point. How it's going to work, how's Daredevil testifying going to stop crime is another thing that we don't know at this point. So in a way, this is sort of a transitional or a setup issue. But we did get quite a bit of action. And the artwork is pretty solid as well. I mean, it's Goran Suzuka rather than the regular artist Ron Garney, but their styles are similar enough that it's not jarring. And you have Matt Millon colors, who's the same as the regular color artist. So that you have that consistency to help out as well. So there's not that much else to say about this issue in terms of, you know, analyzing or breaking it down, other than you kind of wonder about Matt saying, okay, if this doesn't work, I lose everything. But again, we'll find all that out and what exactly Matt's plan is in the next issue. So it was great to see Daredevil teaming up with some other street level heroes. That's always a good time as well. Seeing Echo and seeing Luke Cage was great as well. So that's going to do it for this issue and this episode. As always, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.